It was a last-minute flurry of money, ads, door-knocking, and nail-biting, but the primary is over, and now the political campaigns and parties have to sort out what it means for their chances to win California's battleground congressional seats. We're bringing you the most important post-election takeaways from reporters and strategists watching the race. This is Keys to the House, the podcast from Capital Public Radio about the battleground congressional races and the themes that could determine the election. I'm your host, Ben Bradford. It's a week after Election Day, but there are still ballots left to count, and a few tight races remain at least technically undecided. That includes in some of the districts we've been watching, where Democrats worried they could get locked out, with two Republicans advancing to the general election in what would otherwise be winnable seats for the party. Let's talk about the final days before the vote. LA Times political reporter Christine Mai-Duke describes a frantic scene as national Democrats injected last-minute cash into the races.
Well, I think it's fair to say the level of anxiety is very high for national Democrats. I don't think you would have seen Democratic groups spending $7 million in the closing weeks of the campaign if that was not the case.
Former Democratic strategist Derry Schrego says the money should never have been needed in the first place. He blames the same Democratic groups that were spending big at the end for creating this lockout danger for the party in the first place. He says the party's congressional campaign arm, known as the DCCC, unwisely trumpeted its intention to flip several of these longtime Republican districts in suburban Southern California.
And so they show up here with obviously great expectations, which is fine. But in my world in politics, you don't broadcast those expectations. You set expectations low and then try to exceed them.
Schrego says it sent a message to longtime congressional hopefuls that they should run.
Bad idea.
The result? Wealthy, untested, self-funding Democrats coming out of the woodwork to jump into these races, as many as 8 or 9 in some districts, potentially splitting the vote. Katie Merrill is the political strategist for Fight Back California, a political action committee trying to flip Republican-held congressional districts.
There was not even controlled chaos. You had really no idea. You'd look at these different polls. They were, you know, done by all these different organizations. They were basically showing the same thing, which is there was one Republican who was at the top and then several Republicans and several Democrats bunched together. And so what's the strategy?
Well, the strategy was to attack. Outside groups, including the DCCC, spent millions against Republicans, but not the ones showing up at the top of the polls. Mai-Duke of the LA Times says in the 48th district, which we looked at last episode, money poured in against Republican Scott Baugh.
We saw them spending to kind of attack lower tier Republican candidates. Scott Baugh was a well-known GOP candidate that was running against Dana Rohrabacher, the incumbent, and threatened to take that number two spot because he's pretty well known, and so they spent a lot of money, you know, more than $1 million to attack him to hopefully depress those numbers and help a Democrat then get through.
Republican strategist Jen Jacobs lives in another battleground district, represented by retiring Congressman Daryl Issa.
I'm a Republican voter. I got 108 mail pieces total. And, but what you saw just from the mail and TV and everything else, but you had millions and millions and millions of dollars. You could not turn on TV, couldn't turn on your internet, couldn't turn on anything.
That onslaught, despite the chaos and the host of candidates, appears to have worked. Democrats seem to have avoided being locked out of their target races, in some cases by the skin of their teeth. Scott Baugh spent election night less than 1% behind the second place spot, and technically he could still catch up. Schrego, the political strategist who thinks the DCCC created the conditions for a lockout, credits the National Democratic Group with averting it, and more.
Now, to give the DTRIP credit, they wound up pulling victory from the jaws of defeat because they realized several weeks out, or maybe a few months out, what they had wrought and attempted to fix it, and they proved beyond anybody's question that they're very good at beating the daylights out of candidates. They looked at the candidates on the Republican side who, from their point of view, they did not want to face off against in the general. And they ran, obviously, research on those candidates, found their weak spots, and put millions, literally millions of dollars, into giving those candidates a black eye with voters. And that's what they did. And it worked.
Not only did Democrats avoid a lockout, Schrego says they got something better, weaker Republican opponents in some districts. For instance, Democrats would probably rather face Rohrabacher than Baugh, given Rohrabacher's ties to Russia, which we discussed last episode. But Schrego and Republican strategist Jen Jacobs say the party did its best, or worst, work in the race to replace Daryl Issa.
Rocky Chavez was the local assemblyman. He's a colonel, a former colonel. This is a Camp Pendleton-based district. He was the mayor of Oceanside. In every poll that you saw, he was at 25, you know, mid-20s with all those candidates in the race. And what you also saw is when they did head-to-heads with him with anybody, he was going to win well into the 50s. I mean, he's just fits the district. He's moderate. He's Hispanic. He's a colonel in a very military district. So what the DCCC did is they came in and started attacking him on his moderate votes to Republicans.
Rocky Chavez promised he'd never raise taxes and would oppose wasteful spending. Then Rocky did the opposite.
The Democratic group ran this attack ad against Chavez for compromising with Democrats, specifically helping strike a deal on climate change.
Rocky Chavez's broken promises will knock you out. DCCC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
In a moderate district, the Republican vote consolidated around, instead, Trump-aligned conservative Board of Equalization member Diane Harkey, who will face clean energy attorney Mike Levin in November. The Cook Political Report rates races, and it's moved Issa's seat from a toss-up to leans Democrat. Now, there was plenty to say about the races after primary night and the tactics and the 11th-hour spending that helped shape it. But strategists and campaigners on both sides of the political spectrum instead wanted to grind the same axe, specifically about California's top two primary system, which voters adopted in 2010. Jacobs lays the blame for Chavez's loss on the system, saying it allowed Democrats to meddle in who the Republican candidate is. But Democrats involved in the race aren't happy about the top two system either. Strategist Katie Merrill again.
You know, you have to be Bobby Fischer, right? It's a chess game. You have to look at what happens if you have five candidates on one side and four candidates on the other side, and how do they split that vote? And no party actually gets to nominate their party's nominee.
Supporters of the top two system argue it can be a moderating force in politics by allowing candidates to run to the center and appeal to both less partisan Democrats and Republicans. But people tend to stick to their parties anyway. Here's what Scott Lay, who tracks elections for AroundTheCapitol.com, says we're seeing that's different after the adoption of top two.
We're not seeing anything. We've only had, I think now, two races where two members of the same party progressed to the general election.
In contested districts.
In contested districts. But we're not really seeing that much different. It's basically the same game played all over again.
The same game all over again, meaning the contested congressional matchups are set, and barring an unexpected shift in remaining ballots, they're Democrat versus Republican, none discernibly more moderate than would have come if the parties had run closed primaries. We asked our strategists and reporters what the results tell us about these upcoming matchups. For instance, we've talked about the possibility of a blue wave, but Scott Lay says it didn't show up on election night.
There was no surge discernible right up to the election.
You're saying there was no evidence of a blue wave.
Exactly. I mean, it was California. It looked like a typical election. I mean, there were a couple of surprises, but not at the top level. The overall partisan makeup of the race looked as we would expect.
This was something Republicans quickly jumped on. Here's Rohrabacher at his post-election celebration last Tuesday night.
Oh, there's a blue wave, and it's going to knock us all down. Well, the blue wave didn't hit.
Democrat Katie Merrill describes, as someone working to flip Republican congressional seats, watching California's returns come in.
I was a little surprised after the votes were counted on Election Day that we were at, you know, 19% in Alameda County, 22% statewide. It is unlikely that that doubles. What happened in 2016 is that you added a third, or you added 50% more. So that might mean that we will be at 33% turnout. That's not great for a primary election. It's better than 2014, but that was an historic low. So, you know, and it's not great in the context of the blue wave and all this Democratic enthusiasm. And so the Democrats are going to have to work harder to turn their people out.
There was one exception, one place where turnout did spike for Democrats. It was in Darrell Issa's district. LA Times reporter Christine Maiduk explains.
It's a place where the Democratic activists have been extremely engaged, extremely organized. So if that holds into November, I think that that's an indication of the kind of coming together that Democrats need to work on to be able to be really competitive in these seats.
The generally unexceptional turnout is good news for Republicans, as is the party avoiding its own lockout this primary. In the race for governor, Republican businessman John Cox just trounced Democratic former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa for the second spot in the general election against Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. That's the race at the top of the ticket, and it's the likeliest one to get voters out of bed and to the polls.
Well, look, I think that that's huge for them. Having a Republican candidate at the top of the ticket, that kind of visibility can help with turnout among Republicans. And then obviously another issue that we've talked about is the gas tax.
The gas tax, raised as part of a transportation funding package last year, is looking to be the issue Republicans focus on in the general election. Listen to a piece of Republican gubernatorial candidate John Cox's victory speech from Tuesday.
It wasn't Donald Trump who gave us that gas tax. It was Gavin Newsom, and we're going to repeal that tax in November.
Cox helped fund a ballot initiative that would repeal the gas tax. Republican strategist Jen Jacobs and Democratic strategist Katie Merrill both described this as a key campaign issue.
That's an issue for the parents with a couple kids who, you know, maybe make $60,000 a year, and they're trying to decide if their kid can play soccer this year. This is going to be the message, especially in swing districts, when they're going after, you know, people who might be registered Democrat but are really kind of tends to be a little more conservative, that, you know, you when you actually say to them, 12 cents times da-da-da-da-da, and this is how much per year, it's a lot of money.
It's a big deal. So I always say California is a little more purple than people realize, particularly when it comes to ballot measures. So the gas tax, and particularly on tax measures, we are very purple. So this gas tax measure, and especially based on the results in the Orange County recall, is going to increase Republican turnout, and that could be problematic for us in taking back these seats.
But political data analyst Paul Mitchell, who you may remember from last episode, says campaigns may be missing the point on the gas tax. Now, this gets a little wonky, but hear me out because it could be a key to the election. See, Republicans had arguably their best success last Tuesday in a recall election. They ousted State Senator Josh Newman, a Democrat who voted for the gas tax. Around 60% of the vote was against Newman. The parties are looking at this as a sign that the gas tax is Republicans' most potent issue. But Mitchell says campaigns may have learned the wrong lesson.
You know, Josh Newman was a guy who wasn't supposed to win the primary. His opponent on the Democratic side spent $500,000. He wore a bear suit and stood on street corners, okay? He had signs that said, hey, Newman, like this Seinfeld thing, and literally was in a bear costume on street corners. Now, he kind of had this fluky path through the primary, ended up making it to the general election. People thought he was kind of funny. He won the general election in what most people considered a pretty shocking upset of Ling Ling Chang, and it was carried through because of the, you know, Orange County turning Democratic for the first time, this big wave election we had in the 16 presidential with huge Democratic and young voter turnout, and that swept him into office. Now, once he gets to Sacramento, he is target number one.
Mitchell argues the gas tax was the excuse behind, not the reason for, the recall's success.
The outcome, gas tax or not, was driven by the composition of the electorate. Really was, you know, disfavored a, you know, Josh Newman and his ability to survive the recall. So the gas tax was the way that they made this recall palatable. But the real reason they won was because of the, you know, oversized Republican turnout.
This is another principle of elections. Republicans tend to vote at a steadier rate than Democrats, whose turnout tends to swing more wildly, surging in presidential years and falling off during midterm elections like this one, especially in primaries. Mitchell says that's what we saw this election. So now campaigns are trying to figure out how to whip up turnout, Republicans with the gas tax. For Democrats, Mitchell thinks turnout, at least in the battleground congressional districts, could still increase more than usual from their disappointingly typical primary.
Now, the anomalies are going to come in those congressional races where if you're living in Orange County in one of these competitive races it's almost like it's a national election. You're going to see media trucks in town. You're going to have all this hype. You're going to have commercials wall to wall. You're going to have mailers constantly. You're going to have precinct walkers. There's going to be basically like a national election happening in these tiny little pockets that comprise about 15% of the state's voters. In those areas, I think you could expect to see really elevated turnout. And when they talk about a blue wave, or when they talk about kind of this, you know, taking back Congress, the focus on those districts, I think, is going to be pretty intense.
Before the primary, election watchers like the Cook Political Report, the New York Times, the strangely named but well-respected Sabato's Crystal Ball, had generally rated the chance of either party winning control of the House as a toss-up. Now that the primary is over, it's a toss-up. Neither party left the primary with a noticeable advantage. Or, looked at another way, each party left the primary with their own advantages. For Republicans, that's a candidate in the governor's race, a possibly potent issue in the gas tax, and no sign of dangerously high Democratic turnout. For Democrats, it's just having candidates make it to the general election. Next time, now that the races are set, we'll start diving in and exploring the matchups, such as the Republican congressman who's won as a Central Valley farmer, even though more Democrats are registered in his district. He's likely facing his most potent challenger in years. Keys to the House is produced by Sally Schilling and edited by Nick Miller. Chris Hagen is our digital editor, and the executive producer is Linnea Edmeyer. My brother Matt Bradford composed our theme song and music. You can stay up to date on all of your news, elections, and otherwise by tuning in to Capital Public Radio, going online to capradio.org, or following us on Twitter at @CapRadioNews. This is Keys to the House. I'm your host, Ben Bradford. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.